Hello and welcome back to the For the Love of a Franchise. I'm gonna have difficulty saying that in the future, boys, so you're gonna have to bear with me. I think I'm a little bit pissed, but we are going to be reviewing the third film in the Indiana Jones saga, that is The Last Crusade. And joining me as usual is Paul.
Hello.
That was a rather it was a rather pompous hello. Are you on fucking Downton Abbey tonight?
Do you know what? It's because I've been doing so many impressions of Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Hello there.
And I just say hello. Because I know I can't say hello there. So I cut the there off and it just comes out, hello.
Like, oh, fucking hello, Lord Grantham over there. And also joining us is Tony.
I should have mailed it to the Marx Brothers.
Fucking hell. Jesus, so we've got two impressions of Scottish people going on tonight. We've got fucking Obi-2 Kenobi over there and 00 down there. Fucking hell. Right, so how are we, boys? Did we enjoy the Last Crusade?
I did.
Always do. Always do. Always do.
Good, good. I will not hear.
6 months since I watched it last at Christmas.
I will not hear any a bad word said about this film. This is my favourite film in this saga. And it's just a shame what we've got to contend with next month. But we'll come to that next month. So this is, as I say, my favourite one, just purely from from my background, really. I was brought up Roman Catholic, and things of that nature have always intrigued me because, like, as with many people of my generation, like, I've turned away from that faith. I hardly ever go to church, only under really duress nowadays. But things like holy relics, artifacts, the whole pomposity of the Roman Catholic Church, all that stuff does massively still intrigue me. And to go further into that, a possible franchise I might be looking at in the future might also deal with something like this. But the one that's always got me is things that are directly tied to Jesus in things, obviously, like this film, like the Holy Grail, the Crusades and whatever. And that this film is just automatically right up my alley. The fact that Harrison Ford's in it, Sean Connery's in it, there's Nazis, the Nazis get beat even better. And the Holy Grail, like, you know, this is like my ideal movie, is it? Like a history nut.
The only thing that's missing is the killer bunny.
Yeah. Fucking hell. Do you know what? I'm going to stick that on my list. I've got a list in my phone of all the franchises I'm going to suggest in the future, unless one of you two beat me to it. And to be honest, I never actually thought about choosing Monty Python. I'm going to stick that on.
It's literally my last note. Is a very naughty bunny? No, very naughty boy.
Oh, so where did you guys first see this film? Was it like a home release? Was it in cinema?
It was a cinema which is no longer there now. It was the Empire in Shrewsbury one Saturday afternoon. I think it was opening weekend.
Actually saw it open a weekend. That's boss.
Yeah, and I think it's probably only like the third or fourth trip I'd ever made to the cinema. Like 19 years old, didn't go a lot as a kid. Yeah, because it was like Hereford were probably away somewhere, so me and a mate went and watched it one Saturday afternoon. I the first Indiana Jones film I saw at the cinema. Funny enough.
Yeah. Oh.
For me, it probably would have been on TV. Probably would have been, I'm imagining, I can't even remember what year it came out.
1989.
89. So, yeah, it would have been probably, because I would have been, five at that point. So, I reckon it probably... Yeah, I would imagine it would have either been probably around 91, I would imagine. Yeah. I saw it, so I would have been about 7 and that kind of sticks, sort of that age kind of really does point you in the direction of what you're going to love in the future. Yeah. So it kind of sticks around. And yeah, it's likewise, Josh, it's my favourite in the franchise, by a country mile.
This is the one for me that I have very nearly worn out my VHS copy of this.
And it's the one that if it's on TV while I'm flicking, and I don't do that very often these days. But if I see that it's on, I'm like, oh, I'll just leave it going. And it's pretty much right from the word go with the opening scene, which I'm sure we'll touch on very shortly, that it just grabs your attention straight away.
Yeah, because, well, to be honest, let's dive into it then. With that opening scene, to me, that is the perfect introduction to the character of Indiana Jones. You cannot build that character any better than that entire sequence.
Yep. And I believe it spun off a TV show, didn't it?
What amazed me about it was, I only learned this piece of trivia quite recently. Young Indy is Joaquin Phoenix's brother.
I
did not get onto that until very, very recently.
In fact, I noted down what it was such a sad loss to cinema was, because the guy had some talent, and this camera loved him. He definitely had a future, and just such a waste when he went.
Well, it's the fact that Harrison chose him as well. For me, if you're handpicked by the actor that you're basically playing a younger version of,
wasn't that on the back of Mosquito Coast?
Yes, it was.
They were both in that, weren't they? I think.
I think I'm right in saying they were father and son in it.
That's great. Yeah, that's right. I think I'm sure.
I think so. And do you know what I love? I mean, obviously the chase scene itself is like the main crux of that entire sequence. But I love the character of he's got such a stupid name because he's just basically named after his hat, but he's called Fedora. Could they just not be asked in the writer's room? So fuck it, just call them after the hat.
It's a real great misdirect.
Yes. Yeah, because
that makes you think it's him.
Where he stands, the hat.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, mind you, if you really think about it, like Raiders takes place 1938. If you think about it, he's about what, 30 to 35 in that film, and like. You think like there's a tall, strapping 12-year-old Indiana Jones with a fedora on, looking for the cross of Conrado. I love the chase sequence that comes after this, and especially the music that comes behind it. That is proper chase music.
Homaged in Family Guy of all places as well.
Do you know what? You've just took the words right out of my mouth. That was going to be my next point.
Peter just sits there and he's humming the entire sequence on the sofa.
Do you know what? I could watch that on repeat, that bit. It's so funny. But yeah, it's...
great way, as a prequel, should have set up certain things that we're familiar with. The change in his attitude about snakes, and we'll see the scar that's created in a minute as well.
And that fucking giant snake.
Do you know what, right? This is probably more of a reference to Tony you'll get, but that snake really looks like the really shit puppets from Kinder on Doctor Who. See, I knew you get that, Tony, that I had to make that reference.
Yes, I forgot about that. Yeah, it wasn't great.
it looks shit, but you can get why, obviously, Indy develops his fear of snakes.
Yeah.
The scene with the sheriff when Indy gets back home, that sheriff's a little twat, isn't he?
Oh, not half.
He's a little shit, I was him.
Yeah.
I know it's notorious in this city that we don't particularly care for our law enforcement, but is any wonder when they're portrayed like that on screen?
Yeah.
They're just like shit. What is
this sequence in the house? We hear Sean's voice, we know who the character is, but they don't choose to show him at this point.
Yeah.
He's the younger version of himself. And they probably couldn't
I think it's more for the audience, not so much shock factor, but oh my God factor of when Indy crashes into the the chateau later, and he just comes out of the dark. Yeah. I love the transition between young Indy getting the hat and then just out of nowhere, he's just on a boat in the middle of the sea, pissing down with rain.
Yeah.
But
I love that line. It belongs in a museum.
Really short as well. That entire scene on, I think it's on the Portuguese coast, if I remember rightly. It's a really well put together action scene, actually, considering there's all those weather elements as well for the time.
Yeah,
you do have to say though, it is the good old boat on a soundstage.
Oh god, yeah, god, yeah. I mean, you can tell. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to tell when I was a lot younger and like just seeing this film with the rose tinted glasses, but nowadays you can definitely tell that that's getting shook about by a pair of hydraulics.
Yeah, and you can tell, you can always tell when they black out behind them. Because they're covering where the edge of the tank is.
So obviously Indy returns back to the museum, and now I really, really fucking loved the character of Marcus in the first film. He was such a down to earth, quite obviously knew what he was talking about kind of guy, and I don't want to say that they shit on him in this film, but for some reason, his character is just written so differently.
Yes.
He becomes the comic relief.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I don't mind a bit of comic relief because in some places in this film, it massively works and it just takes you out of the moment very quickly for a bit of lightheartedness when it does get just that little bit dark. And
they kind of swapped it around, didn't they? Because Salah was more the comic relief in the first one.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say, because compared to Temple of Doom, this one is a lot more lighter. And considering the criticism the Temple did get, I get why they moved more towards that lighthearted theme. But sometimes it just doesn't work.
Credit to Denham Elliott for making it work. I think it's a credit to him as well, because he'd done some comedy since Raiders, of course. He'd done Trading Places, one or two other bits and pieces. So at least that was kind of a badge of honor for him in that respect. They felt he could run with a more comedic version of Marcus, and he did. So
yeah, but I love the fact that like Indy is just straight away thrust into this as soon as he gets back to the college, because it doesn't really give you that time to sort of sit and breathe after the escape from the boat and learning in a little bit of Indy's backstory. It just throws you right into it. So I gotta say straight away, love Julian Glover. That man has been in so much stuff of my childhood. Yeah, like, that man is a
great Doctor Who turn needed as well.
Oh, many a Doctor Who turn, actually. Funnily enough, just to tie straight into this particular film, he actually played King Richard in a William Hartnell episode titled The Crusades.
Mm.
So there's your little Doctor Who tie-in. Because you know what I'm like, but
Gareth wasn't he as well?
I watched that one quite recently, actually. But Julian Glover plays the nice guy so easily, and the amount of, I mean, I've obviously watched this film a good bloody number of times, but it's still that turn on a sixpence that he does in the chateau later on. It hasn't got the massive shock value of first time seeing it, but like,
it's quite devastating as well.
Yeah, because he's such a nice guy at the start.
Yeah.
He's brilliant in it, and you can tell that, obviously he's playing a character, but you can tell that the character really does just want to find the Holy Grail. He doesn't want it to, like...
I did note down at one point, because we meet his wife early on, I'm like, did she know that he was a traitorous little shit?
Did she know he was in league with the Nazis? Yeah. She goes into their bedroom, and it's like the scene out of Father Ted when he goes into the priest's little hidey hole and he's got all the fucking Nazi memorabilia. But yeah, Indy now gets sent to Venice to look for his dad and meet up with Jesus Christ, that what that woman does to me. Elsa Schneider, Jesus Christ. I mean, Willie is a good looking woman. Marion is a good looking woman. Elsa Schneider, I know she, like, guys, I know she's a Nazi. I know she's a, you know, a goose stepping Aryan woman. Like blonde hair, blue eyes, all that jazz. Fuck me, she's fit.
Alison Doody was just incredible in that film.
Jesus,
she's such a more capable lead.
Yeah. And I mean, I know she is the girl that gets saved in this film quite a bit, but she actually can hold her own. Now, Marion held her own in terms of, like, she could hold her own in a fight. Willie was just a fucking mess. And but Elsa, she's basically Indy's intellectual equal.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's so well written, and the way in which she actually does move the plot forward, obviously in more ways than just the treachery bit. But she actually like helps Indy figure things out and prompts them to think of things in other ways and whatever. She's brilliant. I love that character.
The film goes out of its way over the course of its couple of hours to sort of point out that she's Austrian, and B, that she's one of those people who joined the Nazi party just because it was the in thing to do.
Yeah.
And just got sucked into it. And that's where we get that a bit later on, that book burning scene, where you can see she's realizing the ramifications of her choices at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. She's certainly not just a two-dimensional blonde girl that they've chucked in for Indy to jump in and save. She's brilliant. The things that I've said over our reviews of these films is I love when Indy actually does some fucking puzzle solving and doesn't just beat 10 bells of shit out of henchmen. I like that stuff more than him like getting chased on motorbikes and all things like that. And I know I always mentioned the Lego games when we review these films, but the puzzle solving in those games based around specifically Indy using his dad's diary to find a way into the catacombs in that library. It's so good. And I wish they just expanded on it a little bit more in the film because, mind you, that's just me being a bit selfish.
I do love that bit where they find a way into the category, because he's already mentioned earlier in the film that X never ever marks the spot.
Yeah,
and the payoff is just brilliant. X marks the spot.
He's like, oh shit!
He's got to be a fucking mind, you know.
Speaking of the catacombs, when they get in there and they're going all through them, whatever, the bit with the rats.
Oh,
fuck me, that's nasty. I mean, I'm not a fan of any four-legged friends that scurry around. You know, I'm not a fan of that in the slightest anyway, but that's just nasty. And I read a little bit of trivia that they actually bred, I think it was like 2,000 rats specifically for this film, and didn't just like go out and capture the loads because, you know, they could carry all kinds of fucking disease. But
and like Alison's got one in her hair at one point, isn't she?
That's fucking grim.
I don't think she really had to act too much to sell that. I suspect she just looked so terrified.
Do you know what? I read another thing that, I mean, as much as it wasn't particularly nice having that happening, like, you know, rats crawling your hair and whatever, apparently the actors weren't that arsed because for some reason Elsa wasn't that bothered just because she wasn't bothered. And apparently Harrison Ford had two pet rats when he was growing up, so he was made up. And I was like, you are a weird child. I love the sort of twist in that when the whole place is set alight by the guys who are following them. So
before we dive out of the catacomb, we can't let that brilliant joke slide, can we, without mentioning the Ark of the Covenant gag.
Oh, yeah. Well, apparently the where this film takes place is apparently up for debate among fandom. Some people seem to think that, aside from that reference, that, oh yeah, that's definitely the Ark of the Covenant, apparently this film takes place before Raiders, but after Temple. Really? Yeah, I don't know how the hell that that works. Let me just get off, because I've got a couple of pages open, because I was reading it before we were recording, and it was just so weird when I was reading it.
I don't get that. It's just the way that he says it and the way the scene's done, and the little bit of the score is just all set up for him to sort of say, yeah, well, yeah, of course it is. I bloody know.
Well,
it is.
Yeah, because she goes, "What's that drawing?" And he goes, "It's the Ark of the Covenant." She goes, "Are you sure about that?" And he goes, "Yeah, sure. Pretty sure." So you're like, okay, so he's obviously encountered it. But
yeah,
the whole it's supposed to take place 2 years after Raiders. So it's evidently that fucking Raiders has happened. Yeah, I love the reveal of how the guys that are trying to kill them in the catacombs are like actually protecting the Grail. So I imagine that they must be onto the fact that Elsa is a Nazi sympathizer. Because, like, I imagine she would have been snooping around with Sean Connery and Julian Glover as well.
There's generally people are looking for it. It was what sort of flagged it up for them. Like, that's how I always read it.
Yeah.
And they just happen to be following Indy and her, basically.
Well, see, I love things like that because it's it goes again into that thing of my own personal history with Roman Catholicism, in that there probably are those sects out there that aren't spoken of that protect holy relics and like keep them from falling into the wrong hands and things like that. And I love the sort of mythology that surrounds those kind of groups. Especially love things like in the Da Vinci Code, that there's an entire group dedicated to protecting those who are directly descended from Jesus.
Yeah.
I love stuff like that, that there's a possibility that, like, there's a quote I love that it's every story ever told actually happened. It's just the details are muddied through time. And so I love the fact that there probably is a cult out there. And in fairness, they're probably off the fucking cake on Wacky Backy or something, but they probably do think that there is a lineage of Jesus Christ and it's their job to protect them for all time. But yeah, I love things like that plays with religion and mythology and whatever. That chateau that Indy and Elsa go to, what the fuck is that accent that Indy puts on? what is that Scottish accent?
I'd written down Groundskeeper Indy at that point.
as long as he's not flashing, it's all good.
Yeah, God Jesus, he just rocks up with a pack of Mac and a berry on. He looked like fucking Frank Spencer.
Betty. Elsa.
Oh, I've had a bit of trouble. I love how he just fucking lamps the butler when he realises he's going to get found out. And that's what I mean about the comedy in this film. Like, there are moments that absolutely stand out as, like, they just work. There's no right or wrong, they just work. And that is one of them. And we'll come to, like, Marcus in a little bit, but, you know, there are bits that don't work, and we'll speak about them, I imagine. I love the German general in this, who, funnily enough, was in Harry Potter. I love just the way he takes on that role and fully throws himself into it. Does not care. Just amps up the Sieg Heil Hitler German to 1,000. It's brilliant. Of obviously one of the greatest actors to ever come out of Scotland, Mr. Sean Connery. That was perfect casting.
Love that.
Absolutely brilliant. And I love the fact that he just absolutely refuses to call Indy Indiana. because
her name
well,
was the dog Sean.
It's the chemistry that the two of them have as well together. It's absolutely fantastic. Like you can tell that they really got on.
Where they eventually find that step, so we'll come to him in a minute. Like he just sits there when he's got his bag on his lap, and it's just the way his stage business is great.
It felt like he was playing someone older than he actually was. There's moments in this where he feels like he's a proper geriatric.
Yeah, because between them, there's only about 12 years.
Yes.
Like that, 12 or 13 years. So, funnily enough, Connery was really reluctant to take on the part. And then I think he actually met Harrison and they just like went to dinner and he said, oh, I've been offered the part in your new Indiana Jones film. And he was like, oh, right, who are you playing? And he said, I'm playing your dad. And because they got on really well and he was like, you should really take that. He said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. I love the chemistry between them two. And obviously we'll talk a bit more about that as we progress through the film. But the whole scene of like where they're tied up and obviously we get the reveal that Donovan's a little shit and Elsa's also a little shit. And, you know, there's a lot of treachery going on.
The whole segment of the Marx Brothers line earlier and the dolls and then, well, the way he wouldn't have it with him and just the look on Harrison's face, on Indy's face. Actually, the whole 10, 15-minute segment is just perfect. It's just
Well, do you know what? I find just a bit after that a bit creepy now that I'm a bit older. But when I was younger, I used to find it really funny. It's when they both realise that they've both shagged Elsa.
Yeah. My note is literally Dirty Henry Sr.
Dirty, dirty boy.
I just written that she talks in her sleep. And it's just... but it's the way that she deliberately leans between the two of them and whispers that line, and you conniving little woman.
I suppose we'll talk about the escape scene now. The comedy in this is again A1.
It kind of feels very Benny Hillish at times.
It does, but at the same time, it really works for me.
The radio operator that sees them and she smiles.
And it's like quite clearly the Germans are faster than them.
Yeah.
So how the hell are they not catching them?
Oh, no.
Do you know what else? It's when the fireplace is turning round.
Yeah.
The Germans are just stood there firing and they're quite obviously just fucking aiming at the floor.
Yeah.
It's so blatant.
Well, they probably just hired the stormtroopers.
Yeah, from Star Wars, yeah.
Yeah.
Fancy getting up in the Nazi uniform and just shooting at the floor, mate. Yeah, go ahead, I can do that.
That's just Han Solo!
Is that this Han Solo and Unt James Bond? What is going on here? Do you know what, funnily enough, there's a lot of, I think a good majority of the actors in this film have been in a Bond film, you know? Because obviously the big film is Sean Connery. But Glover was in A View to a Kill. Or was he in For Your Eyes Only? Elsa was in. She was in For Your Eyes Only, actually.
She was in A View to Kill.
I've got them mixed up then. Yeah, so one was in one was in the other. Yeah, a good couple of the. I think the German general that's in it, the Nazi, he's been in one of them as well. I'm not sure which one it is though.
It's the best the Brits won it and just.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's kind of a staple of Lucasfilm films, isn't it? Like they get the odd American in, but the majority are like Shakespearean actors.
And that's because the bulk of them were filmed here.
Yeah, it's literally just a Pinewood thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the chase sequence with the motorbikes and how basically like he fools them with the boat and everything.
Before we leave the castle completely, I just wanted to say I like the Austrian way better too.
The Austrian way?
Of saying goodbye.
Oh, I don't blame you.
That kiss she gives him, blimey. That bit of that lip suck at the end. Oi, 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 mate.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I wouldn't mind a quick snog off Alice and Judy, but, you know, just can I have my lip back, please, love? Jesus Christ. The chase sequence, that is so well put together.
Yeah. Although, did they not notice that there was actually nobody in that boat when it was going down the river to start with?
Before they come out, probably thought they were lying down or something, didn't they? But I love that motorbike scene, especially with the jousting thing, because obviously it's hints at, like, you know, the knights and the crusades, etc. Just a nice little nod for that one. But the bit in this sequence, the whole chase sequence thing, that is just brilliant is when he has the lance and it breaks after he sort of spears the guy, and then there's another one that comes up beside him and he just sticks it in the spokes and it goes fucking flying. I think it's absolutely brilliant. To Berlin, which is, this is just such a strange scene, because of all the people that you think Indiana Jones would go up against, you would not think the toothbrush moustache knobhead of 1930s Berlin would be showing up.
Well, you mean Mr. No. Bronson?
Yeah, that's exactly
Charles Bronson. Yeah,
that was exactly my note. I'd completely forgotten that they showed the Führer for a start, and then the fact that it's played by the guy from Grange Hill.
Yeah, I think he played Hitler in one or two things as well, possibly.
Yeah, I think he did as well.
Yeah.
What I want to point out is the signpost just happens to have both destinations that he needs to go to.
Berlin or Venice.
That's
brilliant.
Hollywood, baby.
Or in the case of Venice, the Docklands, wasn't it? I think possibly shot some of that stuff.
Yeah.
One little quick fact I meant to mention about the motorbike chase scene. All actually filmed on Skywalker Ranch.
Ah.
Yeah. So there's your little bit of trivia for all you fact fans. Obviously, we get that sort of very quick scene, but it's actually quite a powerful scene between Indy and Elsa. Obviously, as you said, Tony, you can see that she's obviously beginning to regret her actions and regret her allegiance to the Nazi party. But I think rather than that being the reason for her quite obvious show of emotion, I think it's more about the fact that they're burning the books, personally.
Yeah. Because it is, yeah. Because she's an
academic, isn't she? So,
and that kind of that stuff they did flies in the face of everything that she's experienced till now.
See, I watched the film again this morning, like a little quick refresh. But I tried to do a bit of Google while I was watching it, because obviously the film's supposed to take place 2 years after Raiders. Or two months even. So that would make it about June-ish. And I remembered when I did GCSE history, there was a lot of talk about, like, you know, the burning of books and things like that. But we were only ever taught that it happened once, right at the start of the Nazi Party rise to power. And I tried to look up when this would have taken place, just to try and get it as a pinpoint thing. And apparently they stopped doing it 2 years before this film takes place. And I'm like, right, so there's your a point taken off for historical accuracy. I'm a terrible stickler for that stuff. I love on the Zeppelin.
Yeah, I'd written down, this is the first time we really see some, by today's standards, a bit dodgy FX at this point, isn't it, with the Zeppelin?
Yeah, it is. But at the same time, it doesn't take you out of it.
No. Although the bit at the end of that sequence with the German officer sort of waving, it just reminds me of that scene in one of the Simpsons episodes of the Lemon Tree. with the blokes in the junkyard going, shake harder, boy.
It probably does include my favourite joke, though. The
no,
when he punches
no ticket.
Him, no ticket.
No ticket. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. But brilliant, so going back to the special effects, the thing about special effects across any film, if it's like now, the modern day, when, you know, everything looks super photorealistic, like, but even going back to, like, you know, 1930s, 1940s films when special effects were just beginning to take off, if the special effects are not bad enough to take me out of the film, like, my suspense of disbelief, as it were, I don't care. And, like, if I was to show a film with quite shoddy CGI, but it didn't take me out of it, if I was to show that film to one of my cousins who has grown up on super photorealistic special effects of, like, Marvel films, Star Wars, etc., of today's standards, they would watch that and go, that's fucking awful.
Mm.
Whereas I think, personally, my generation can watch things like that and still suspend our disbelief. And that makes me quite sad about for future generations of moviegoers, because they will not fork out the cash to keep cinemas, and probably even with the upcoming of streaming service, they will not fork out their cash on a monthly basis to go and watch films, TV shows without super realistic effects. And what makes me sad more in the fact of that is that cinema and TV and stuff like that are supposed to be distant cousins of theatre. And when you go and see theatre, like, I once went with school to see a production of Richard III in theatre. And as the actor was giving this big speech, who was playing Richard III, his armies were at the Battle of Bosworth with Henry VII. And there were all kinds of, like, chains falling around him from high up in the rafters of the stage, and that was representing his armies falling to the might of the Tudors. And that sort of symbolism and suspension of disbelief is something that's going to die out quite quickly, for especially for the upcoming generations, and that really does make me sad. But anyway, I've digressed for long enough. Going back to the whole Zeppelin bit, the bit just after he punches the German officer, and obviously they get away on the Zeppelin, the bit where they're having that little heart-to-heart. I don't know if you guys know about this, but Harrison Ford and Sean Connery both filmed that scene with no pants on.
I've read that somewhere, yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't know that until this morning. And I'm probably never going to be able to watch that scene the same way ever again.
Yeah, I mean,
because
Peter Cushing being Grand Moff Tarkin in his slippers is bad enough, but
no, that I can understand, because you only ever see Peter Cushing in jackboots once.
Yeah,
so you can get away with that. But the fact that there's an entire lower half of clothing missing from Sean Connery, the greatest James Bond that ever lived. He's sat in there with his, you know, his tackle out. Well, no, he's not sat with his tackle out. He probably had underwear on. But you know what I mean? But two grown men sat there, like, just in your undies. You know, hang on a minute. That's just fucking weird. the bit with the plane, like, the whole plane sequence, I love that. The fact that, like, Henry Jones Sr. is obviously so inexperienced in these types of adventures, and it's only the fact that he's gotten into this one adventure with his son that he's having to learn all this new stuff really quickly. He doesn't even know what, like, 10 o'clock is in terms of, like, aiming for something. I think it's just really funny.
And I do want to point out, it's Harrison Ford crashing on a plane, so what's new there?
Moving swiftly on.
Oh my god. Oh Jesus. Wait, I'm not being funny. That had to come up at some point, didn't it?
Yep. At least we haven't brought the earring up yet.
And then they turn into freaking carjackers straight after. They nick the bike's car.
Do you know what? That really makes me laugh that he's literally just about to put that finishing touch on his trim and straight off. But the bit where the Spitfire's coming after him and the bit in the tunnel, that is one of the funniest bits of this film. Like, I know you love the bit on the Zeppelin, Paul, but yeah. just the utter bewilderment of that Nazi pilot in the tunnel is just perfectly played. And funnily enough, I actually read that that scene was supposed to be used in Crystal Skull.
That's my only real beef with the film is that sequence. Is that 1 minute that cockpit is right behind them, the next minute it's going by the side of them and in the same narrow tunnel space. I think, how's that happened then?
It's just a strange one, really. Next, obviously, we get the bit with Marcus. And this is the bit that I really wanted to talk about mainly. Marcus's character should not, well, he should be a bumbling British idiot, but not to the extent that he's portrayed. I think it kind of undermines the essence of his character. Like, he runs a fucking museum filled with all kinds of antiquities and relics of the ancient world. Mm. And he apparently got lost in that fucking museum. Like, what the fuck? No, that's just stupid.
It's also the film that gave us Alexei Sayle playing a king. So
true. But I gotta say, I love any Indiana Jones film that Salah is a part of.
Mm.
That man could do anything, and I'd be okay with it. He could probably betray Indy in a bit of expanded media, and I wouldn't care. It's Salah. I like him. Leave him alone.
And that's what I said. That it seems to follow the same tropes as the earlier films, where all the story is front-loaded, and then the back end just becomes a continuous action sequence for the most part. But this one is saved by those four leads being so good.
Oh, yeah.
And the camaraderie between the four of them is brilliant.
Yeah, the camaraderie is good, but the thing is that Marcus does actually take me out of the film every so often with the comedy, and I don't particularly care for it. It does work in certain bits, don't get me wrong. Like, for example, the final bit at the very end of the film where he's on the horse and he goes, I know the way, and he just can't control that horse.
The line about the pen being mightier than the sword is just so cringeworthy.
Yeah, that's the perfect example for me. But I suppose we talk about the main action sequence scenes, how you sort of mentioned that, Paul. The whole thing with the tank and the horses and then obviously the protectors of the Holy Grail arrive and everything to try and help them, whatever. Like, that is a fantastically put together sequence.
Mm. Yeah.
I think it's absolutely brilliant. Just everything from the fights on the tank to in the tank, around the tank, using the environment to, blow up the side machine guns on the tank. It's the fact that you put that much effort into it and it pays off and it doesn't look shit, basically. But I love the fact that Sean Connery again gets to flex his, not so much his actor muscles, but his action man muscles, like, because he hadn't really done it for a time since leaving Bond. Like, because obviously by this point in history, Roger Moore is like well in the thrust of Bond films. I think he was onto number 5 by this point, out of the 7 he did, if memory serves. It's nice to see that again, because the man could throw a punch on screen, and he never really got that many action-based roles afterwards. If he did, it was more with a gun than his actual fist. It's a really good scene, that. I love the stunts in this one as well. Actually, the one where Indy jumps from the horse to the tank, I think it got voted the best stunt in cinema in 2002 in a poll by Sky users. I don't know why Sky users get to decide shit like that, you know. It's just a strange thing. But the bit where the tank goes over the hill, not the hill, what am I on about? Over the canyon, and the acting out of Sean Connery in that, like, that's just absolutely brilliant, because again it goes back to the chemistry that he and Harrison had between them.
Yeah, there's a real sweet connection between them in that scene.
And again, Paul, it's like you said at the start of the record, you kind of wish that you'd have seen more of him and Indiana as a young lad, because it would have built up what Indy says about his dad never really being there.
Yeah, definitely.
Because then you get that thing of when he thinks he's lost his only son. Like, that would have added a lot more depth to that scene, I think, and especially to Connery's acting. Obviously, they then make their way, like, into the canyon of the Crescent Moon, and come across the temple where lies the Holy Grail. Obviously, that temple is a real place in there. I think it's Jerusalem. Someone correct me if I'm wrong. But it's just... That is a beautiful... I don't know if it was carved or it was built, but that was a fantastic find. If someone just, like, sat in the production office thinking, oh, do you know what? I've been there on holiday. We could use that. Because that does actually look like it was constructed in, like, the middle of the Crusades.
Mm.
It's a beautiful piece of architecture. Now, we come to the bit that is, in my opinion, the best bit in this entire franchise. And it's the trials, what I call the trials of the Grail.
Just before that, briefly, we had that trope. Why is it that Indy and his friends are always discovered hiding in the rocks, watching everything?
my note was, caves, the home of any good Indy finale.
Yeah.
Because it always ends up in a cave.
Yeah.
Well, except for Crystal Skull.
Ends up in a cave as well.
Kind of a cave.
Well, that's what I mean, except for Crystal Skull, because it's not a fucking good ending. But the trials...
It's really clever.
It's just good writing.
Yeah.
You've got good writing. You're already on to a winner, no matter how shit it's put on screen. If it's well written and well thought out, you're on to a winner. And the only thing I will say about it, though, is where the fuck did they get them giant blades in the 11th century?
Yeah, how did they get them in there?
With really bad CGI.
Yes.
Although, speaking of the CGI for this particular bit, the bit where the guy goes in just before Indian that gets discovered, and, like, he sees his mate on the floor with his head chopped off, that's some great model work. In terms of, like, you know, like a mannequin or whatever, like, that's really convincing that someone's had their fucking head chopped off there.
And then we also get a really nice bit of CGI, because I think my favourite bit of this sequence is the leap reveal, and it's photographed.
Yeah.
And the bit where he throws the sand across is really nice shot.
Yeah. Well, it's the fact that how well they made that that walkway blend in the side of the wall. That was fantastic, that, especially for the time. But I've got to admit, that's a fucking pathetic attempt at taking someone's life by that 700-year-old knight. He just fucking gets out the chair, gets a sword, and goes for Indy, and you're like,
oh, you vanquished me. Pull me back.
and that's a scratch.
That's, as I said, he's just a very naughty boy.
the bit where Donovan is killed, that is a fucking nightmare material. That.
Well, the thing.
My note on that was Tales from the Crypt effects.
Yeah.
because that's what it looks like.
Yeah. Well, ILM who produced the effect, like they had over, I think it was over 20 separate, like sort of model dolls that they obviously superimposed into the shot, but they composited them all together and did like a timeline of where they aged it from each one individually, and then obviously into the final skeleton. But I tell you what adds to that more than the CGI for me, it's the reaction of Elsa. And it's the acting that she puts through on it. It's the fucking scream.
Just before that, I noticed something for the first time ever in watching this film. Is after Donovan's taken the cup from her, and he goes to drink, she actually briefly looks across at Indy and shakes her head. And I've never noticed that before until...
Do you know what? Now you've said that, I've never noticed that. I'm going to go back and rewatch that.
It's just a little 1 second kind of, she looks at Indy, just as a quick shake of her head to say,
oh,
no,
I have to look for this.
And I never noticed it before until watching it this time around. So
I'm
she always
have to go back
sets
and watch it
up the scene.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the thing that, the only part of the plot that I'd change for this is I wouldn't have like 101 different cups for them to choose from.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't even have six. I'd just have the grail itself. And what I'd do is I'd have the final test be, you drink from the cup no matter what. And basically the cup knows your intentions of why you want and why you sought out the grail. And basically based on that, it judges whether you receive eternal life or not. I think that's more of a pure and... I'm hesitant to say it, but Christian way of doing it. Because
I don't know, because it's kind of, he's gone for the greed option, isn't he? He's so, oh yeah, that looks like a cup worthy of a king. He's gone for the sort of...
Well, yeah, see, I
understand
that. My note
was always the shiny cup. Always.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and see, I understand that in that basically, you know, Donovan thinks that, you know, Jesus is the king of kings and he's the king of heaven, etc. And he would have a cup that's fit for a king. But that's why I kind of think in terms of the aspect of whether you're worthy to have eternal life, because surely God only wants good, faithful, holy people in his kingdom. So someone who just wants eternal life, literally just to sit out eternity, doesn't want to use it for the good of God's people. You know, that person... in God's eyes, you know, the wrath of God would deserve to die. So that's why I kind of rewrite that.
I just think it'd look a bit shit when they go in there and there's like one cup just sat on the side on the shelf. Hello, they had a stale on.
Well, see, that's why I kind of think the version I would write personally would have been only slightly better in that basically the cup knows the true desires of your heart, even if you don't know it. So Donovan might be thinking, oh, I literally just want to sit out eternity. I don't want to use it for good nor evil. I just want to just live forever. Whereas Indy wants it to cure his fucking dad, who's just been shot 5 minutes ago. Do you know what I mean? And somehow hasn't already bled to death from it. But but yeah, obviously that the death of Donovan, that is a scary scene. That's up there with the face melting of Raiders for me. It's bloody disgusting. But I love the bit at the end where obviously greed takes precedent, one of like the seven deadly sins, and you know Elsa gets hold of the cup after Indy's dad's
cured.
I was
so glad that they killed her off, but it was her own bloody fault though. You just see it in her eyes. You just completely the avarice and the prize in her eyes, isn't she?
Yeah.
Oh, Elsa.
That was literally my final note was she deserved it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know I'm one of those people who's like, no one ever deserves to die, but I'm kind of like, look, you kind of put yourself in that position. I'm sorry. Do you know what I mean? But what I love is the very quick but powerful moment between Indy and his dad, in that Indy very nearly goes the same way as Elsa. Yeah. Yeah. And it's his dad who basically had the obsession for the past 30 years that says to him, nah, pack it in. Let it go. Yeah.
Let it go.
And it's such a powerful scene to me. Now, there's a bone of contention that I had.
The connection between Elsa and Let It Go. Hooray.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Jesus Christ.
Hey!
Yeah. Oh, God, I've just fucking done it again. Bloody hell. I always had a bone of contention with this film, and it's purely down to the fact that I didn't understand it and didn't listen to the dialogue when I was a kid. I didn't understand why Indiana Jones drinks from the cup of the Holy Grail, supposedly receives eternal life, and then in the next film is a 60-year-old man and doesn't stay a 30-year-old dude. And it is literally because I did not listen to the dialogue in that if you pass the Great Seal, the boundary of immortality is removed.
Yeah, it just
and I never got that for like a good 10 years.
Just a good dose of medicine whilst you're in there that cures your ailment there and then, but you don't get any sort of immortality from it. It's just, yeah.
Well, see, that's the thing that I mean. I kind of do get it to a point now, but I don't understand why Indy drinks from the cup and is immortal while he is in the chamber or the temple where the Holy Grail is housed. And then obviously they leave the temple. Indy is no longer immortal. Fine, I get that. No problem. Henry Jr., Henry Sr. even, is shot and cured by the water of the Holy Grail. If he steps out of the temple, does the wound not reopen and he just fucking dies on the spot?
No, I just mean you can only get the benefits of immortality by being in that cave with that cup and that water for all that time.
Right, okay, I mean, like I say, I get it to a point, but and at the same time...
That's the first of it. The only way you can get immortality is to be banged up in that bloody room with the grail.
So I feel sorry on that poor fucking knight, though. He waited 700 years for Indiana Jones to come along and he fucks off.
His home.
You bastard. Yeah. I'll sue your ass. But just as a final note, I love the reveal that Indy took his name from the dog.
The dog?
You named yourself after the dog? It's brilliant.
Yeah.
And do you know what? I'm glad he kept it. I don't care. So I suppose we just move on to some final thoughts then. This is without a doubt my favourite film in this franchise. It is one that I will stick on literally just as background noise, but at the same time, I know exactly what's happening at each point. It's not the most iconic. I'd say it's probably the most forgetful. And yes, I do include Crystal Skull in that. The only reason Crystal Skull is not the most forgettable is because it is the shittest, so everyone remembers it for that. But this is considered in the fandom, according to IMDb anyway, as the second greatest film in the franchise, which, considering the Temple of Doom is considered the greatest in general terms by the wider fan base, Raiders apparently comes in as the second worst film in the franchise, which is mad. But considering there's only actually one bad film in this franchise, that's fair going, I'd say. So let's get some final thoughts from you guys then, and maybe some scores, and I'll give you my score at the end.
I think for me, I really like this film. I say it's the first one I saw at the cinema. The only problem for me with it is that it's not Raiders. Raiders was the first one I saw, and that's the one that's my go-to of the four. And this basically just tucks in behind it. It's got the same elements. It's got the Nazi, Hitler's obsession with finding everything, all the treasures that are out in the world. It's got Nazis. It's got trickery, it's got Sean Connery, and it's a really fun, fab, second best film for me in the franchise. That's the only thing is that Raiders just edges this out for me because Raiders is the first one that I saw, and I think that's probably reflected by most people. I know other people that Crusade is their favorite because that's the first one they saw. So yeah. I totally get that, and I think that's the power of the film itself generally. And I think it just has to affect my score slightly. I think I gave Raiders something in the 90s. So I have to just to keep it in second place, just have to tuck this one in at maybe something like 89%. So it just comes in behind me. But it's if I could only ever watch two of them from now until the day I die, it would be the two with the Nazis in. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. It's just, it makes sense, doesn't it? Indian Nazis or Indian Soviets.
Yeah.
It does just make sense. Yeah. Paul?
Yeah. The one major note I want to take away is just how great the action sequences are. I pretty much wrote down Trains, Planes, and Automobiles. Because they literally just use every single way of travel through this. There's boats, horses, planes, cars, everything, motorbikes. There's literally everything, and they're all and tanks. Yeah, and it's all so well put together. And that's my biggest takeaway is that the action sequences in this are just out of this world. But my final notes were, and there's the end of one of the greatest trilogies of all time. Everything you want in this film: action, adventure, great chemistry, superb casting. This is the ultimate in the trilogy, and it all heads south from here.
Well, it might not. We'll see how 2023 goes.
Well, how we the don't mystical Zimmer frame goes.
Score? Is it going to be scored by Hans Zimmer frame?
And on scores, 91 out of 100.
Okay. Okay, fair enough. My score, I'm pretty sure I gave Raiders about a 96 and Temple, I think it was just below, maybe a 94, but memory serves. So I would probably say this, because it is my favourite and it is, I'd say, probably the most well put together and the one with the very fewest amount of plot holes and things that I would change, either from a narrative or visual or whatever point of view, I would go very easily for a 98 on this. The only reason it does not get a 99 or a perfect 100 for me is because some of the comedy falls flat on its arse sometimes and is, as Tony said, with particularly with the pen mightier than the sword quote, is just cringy in some places. I mean, it makes you giggle because but that is because it is cringy. So yeah, I will go with a 98 for this.
Yep.
So that wraps up our trilogy of Indiana Jones films. As Paul said, it is downhill from this point. God help us. We will be back next month with our review of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. We do hope you will join us. You can find us on social media. We are BPB Podcast Productions on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter is also there as well. Please do give us a like, comment, anything. A share massively helps us. If you can also give us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you get your podcast, that also helps us out massively. We do hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we will see you next month.